Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
New year, same fish bites. Eli Sussman here for the first podcast episode of 2020, the first of very, very many on the Fish Stripes podcast feed. Subscribe if you don't already. Follow us on social media if you don't already, at Fish Stripes on Twitter and at Fish Stripes on Instagram, where we are coming up fast on 1,000 followers. We cover the Miami Marlins like nobody else. And we won a lot of company on this ride heading into 2020. I wanted to plug a couple recent website features for us during this offseason. Spencer Morris, who has a big background in covering the Astros, but he's really intrigued by the recent changes in the Marlins system. And he wrote up something on right-hander Evan Fitterer, who was the fifth-round draft pick in this most recent draft for the Marlins, the very first pitcher off the board. And in some ways, one of the biggest pitching investments that the Marlins have made in anybody under new ownership. Remember, last offseason they signed Sergio Romo to a couple million-dollar deal. But aside from Sergio Romo, Fitterer has been the most expensive pitcher acquired by the Marlins under new ownership. He's a guy that at the time, I think he had just turned 19, right after the draft. So obviously very young. They're betting on his potential. And Spencer is pretty high on Fitterer and his possibility of being a long-term rotation piece for the Marlins. He got his feet wet in the Gulf Coast League this past summer, and he showed the highest ground ball rate out of all prospects in the Marlins system. So that's a tendency to watch, and he's someone that is very projectable, where he already has good stuff, particularly his fastball and breaking ball, but there's the potential for him to add even more velocity to that, and he'll be an exciting guy to follow. Still a little unclear what his next step will be in 2020. Will the team be aggressive and put him all the way up to Clinton in low A full season ball, or will they cue him down in extended spring training for a little while and have him pitch another abbreviated season? Time will tell. The other feature comes from Tyler Wilson, who, like Spencer, is going to be primarily sticking on the prospect coverage side. He wrote up the whole backstory of Aaron Northcraft, who was a recent non-roster invitee to Marlins spring training on a minor league deal, coming off a great season for AAA Tacoma, the Mariners affiliate. But there's so much more in his entire last decade of professional baseball that led up to that point, which was a big jumping off point to get him this deal and put him on the verge of realizing a dream and pitching in the major leagues. He doesn't have any major league experience right now, but ever since coming back from a series of injuries, first a partially torn UCL in his elbow and then a hand issue as well, a couple procedures that kept him out nearly two full years, he returned to action, and since then, both in the Mariner system and then prior to that pitching internationally, he was lights out. He changed his arm angle. He has a very low release point that he throws from. Doesn't have top-end velocity, but it's because of the angle that he throws from and now his ability to consistently throw strikes that has opened up a whole new possibilities for this guy that now in his late 20s, considering how much of his prime that he lost to injury, it's all of a sudden he has a new lease on his baseball life and certainly somebody to watch in spring training that could potentially nab a roster spot. Seems like a really genuine personality, someone that gained a greater appreciation for playing this game after missing all that time because of injuries. And we're really curious to follow his journey from here. Both of those articles on Evan Fitterer and Aaron Northcraft on the website, fishstripes.com. And one more plug for a new thing. I finally got around to setting up the Fishstripes YouTube channel. Previously, I'd uploaded some stuff on my personal account, the Eli Sussman channel, but I thought it was best to anything that's specific to Fishstripes, things that we embed on the website and share snippets of on social media, where I put it up on YouTube, and there's not really any limitations to the lengths of the videos. So we already uploaded some stuff this past weekend. There's going to be some exclusive things that we put on YouTube and that we won't spread around to other platforms. You'll have to subscribe to Fish Stripes on YouTube to get it there. So go ahead and subscribe. Only a handful of people have so far, so you'll be one of the first, and we appreciate everybody that follows us on this ride. Now, on the rest of this Fish Bites episode, I want to go in depth on three particular recent events that have the potential to affect the Marlins in 2020 and even for years beyond that. Then we're going to finish up with a conversation about who I believe to be the most obvious contract extension candidate in the Marlins organization. I can promise you it is not who you expect. This past week, Starlin Castro finally found a new home. The Marlins infielder the past 2 years was a free agent for the very first time, and he has signed a two-year deal, 2 years, $12 million guaranteed with the reigning World Series champion, Washington Nationals. So it shouldn't come as any surprise that he left the Marlins. He was sort of being squeezed out of the team even during this past season, if you'll remember. Acquired originally by the team in the Giancarlo Stanton trade, and he was considered somewhat of an albatross. Like, he was very expendable to the Yankees. On the Yankees, he's being pushed out of a job by top prospect Gleyber Torres, and now with the Marlins, he's being pushed out of a job by former top prospect Eason Diaz. He was put into the deal because he had a couple years remaining on his contract before that at eight-figure salaries, both in excess of $10 million in 2018 and over $11 million this past year. The Marlins held a $16 million club option on him for the 2020 season, and they chose to decline that instead, issuing him a $1 million buyout. So he doesn't fully recoup all that money that he would have made on the club option in this new deal. But all things considered, he makes out relatively well, considering that second baseman, the free agent market has been oversaturated with second baseman this year. In a year that, if you've looked around the league, you'll notice that free agents are doing very well for themselves relative to the previous couple of years. The one exception to that, in the most part, has been second base, where there are just so many players out there that play that position and don't have much other flexibility. In reporting this deal, Ken Rosenthal of The Athletic noted that Starlin indicated a very strong preference for remaining at second base. In 2019, as Eason Diaz was tearing it up in AAA, and for the entire first half of the season, as Starlin was really struggling offensively, the team eventually called up Eason in early August, and that shifted Starlin from second base to third base. In third base, a position he had very minimal experience at any level of pro baseball. It was totally foreign to him, but because he had slumped so badly early in the season, and the Marlins wanted to trade him, and if not even dump his salary, just a part of it, just open up the space for them to play Eason regularly, they weren't able to find a taker for him, and but they wanted to keep him in the lineup.
On a hop, what a play by Castro. Up and throws, got him. Wow, Starlin Castro. It's been a week and a half over at third, or it's been 10 years. What a play. Now, fantastic reaction time by Starlin. One step into the hole, comes up with that baseball. Well done, Starlin.
So they moved him over to third base, and that shifted Brian Anderson out to right field. And from that point forward, Starlin's bat actually caught fire. He was excellent offensively down the stretch. Anyway, you slice it, he was the best hitter on the Marlins for the last several months of the season. And that's, if not for that hot streak, he probably would be settling for a one-year deal, just like Jonathan Scope did, just like Cesar Hernandez did. A couple other second basemen in the same age range as Starlin, both that had their own flaws, and both of them took about one-year, $6 million deals. Castro was able to get a second year added on to that. A guy that, even at his worst, Starlin is a bona fide major league player. I think the question moving forward is whether he's a true everyday player. The Marlins just did not have many competent bats that were major league ready these past few years, and that allowed Starlin to expect himself to be in the lineup every single day. He played all 162 games this past season after playing 154 the previous year. Easily the most playing time of anybody in the Marlins organization during those two seasons. 34 total home runs, including career highs last year in both home runs and RBIs. He's a guy that the big mystery is going to be distinguishing between the terrible first half he had and his resurgence later in the year. Which one of those is more indicative of what he's going to do moving forward? During the first part of the year, what was so strange about it is that he was making contact at a very high clip, one of his lowest strikeout rates of his career early on. The problem was that this is where I find some StatCast data to be very useful. We could tell that his launch angle was all out of whack. He was pounding everything into the ground. And the one thing that's really changed for the worse about Starlin as his career has gone on is that he has lost some athleticism. He came up to the majors as a plus runner, and his sprint speed has gone down to right around the league average at this point. And to be very blunt, there are some situations where he doesn't exactly hustle to the max trying to beat out ground balls. So even his full athletic capability, that's not necessarily all that relevant, because he could say he underachieves those measurables sometimes because of his frustration. Regardless, when he's hitting the ball on the ground, it's very bad. It's usually not going to go very well. He grounded into a ton of double plays during each of the last 2 years. And whatever adjustments he made right in the middle of the season, they allowed him to get the ball in the air more often. And he led the team in home runs over those last few months of the year. And as I mentioned, a career high overall in the season for home runs. Some of that, of course, helped by the juiced ball that was in play this year. But, of course, he was playing half his games at Marlins Park, which this coming season is going to have smaller dimensions. And we're going to get into that in just a little minute. But last year was one of the most pitcher-friendly ballparks in baseball, especially in terms of suppressing home runs. Anyway you slice it, his full season stats were decent, and the Nationals aren't making a huge gamble on him. That's not compared to like how much they invested to bring back Steven Strasburg. And they've added a few other complimentary pieces aside from Strasburg, with Castro being one of them. So he's not necessarily lock to play every single day for them, but he had a preference to stick at second base, and that's a position that they had available. So he's going to get his wish in that department for his age 30 and age 31 seasons. He's going to be in the division, and you're going to see him really soon at Marlins Park, because the Nationals are visiting Marlins Park in the very first homestand of the year, beginning on March 30th. It's unclear where Castro will bat in the lineup. The past few years, he was accustomed to batting in the top half of the lineup, but the Nationals, even with Anthony Rendon leaving, they, of course, have some very intriguing players, from Trey Turner, Adam Eden, Juan Soto. Victor Robles is a guy that could continue to take strides forward. At top prospect, Carter Kieboom is expected to have a pretty significant role on their 2020 seasons. So I would say in most cases, Castro is going to be batting in the bottom half of the lineup for the first time in several years. That'll be a big adjustment to him, but he gets to join a contender. Anyway you slice it, the Nationals In the most pessimistic view, they're still going to be a very competitive team coming off a World Series with a lot of returning talent. And just a final word on Castro as a Marlin. He was the guy that when the trade was reported, he expressed some dissatisfaction through his agent about not wanting to be involved in another rebuild. He went through the coldest years of the Cubs rebuild. As soon as he came to the Yankees, they rebuilt on the fly. His first year there, they missed the playoffs, and they sold off at the trade deadline. And then 2017, he, as the team immediately sprung back to being good again, he had his role somewhat reduced. I think some of that was injury-related as well. But he wanted to finally be in the middle of a contending team, and it seems he's going to get his wish with the Nationals while he was with Miami. He put up overall really decent numbers, especially relative to his teammates, and there was not a single bad word about him being with the team. He seemed to really embrace being a veteran presence on the team, and he was cooperative with the rest of his teammates. There's really nothing there about him being anything less than a great professional on and off the field, and we appreciate his time there. It'd be ideal, I guess, if he had started off 2019 hot and made himself tradable in the middle of the year when it was clear that the organization was moving in a different direction. But, I mean, some of that's just not fully within your control. If you look at from 30,000 feet up, the overall picture, he was exactly what the Marlins had expected. And, of course, accepting him allow them to acquire a couple other prospects in that Stanton trade, and we're going to see how George Guzman and Jose Devers go from here. But the first piece that has resolved itself, as we begin to finally get far enough away from those rebuilding trades to judge them, picking up Castro as basically a salary dump proved to be a very decent investment for pretty much everybody involved. Everybody gets their way out of this, no hard feelings, and I imagine that Castro will get some nice warm reception from the crowd when he makes his return to Miami about 3 months from now. Shortly after the Starlin Castro news broke, the Marlins made an addition for themselves on Friday, signing switch pitcher Pat Venditti. What does that mean? Well, you can either throw with your left hand, you can throw with your right hand, or you can switch between your hands. Pat Venditti is the only active switch pitcher in the high levels of professional baseball right now. And I could spend a whole episode just on Pat Venditti. He's an interesting guy. He has some major league experience. You may not have noticed it. He hasn't pitched very often against the Marlins, but he has bounced around to 6 different organizations over the past 5 years, making his major league debut with the Oakland A's back in 2015, then Toronto, Seattle. He was in the Phillies organization in 2017 and didn't make it to the big leagues. More recently, with the Dodgers in 2018 and with the Giants in 2019. A guy that overall has 68 innings of major league experience, an ERA right around 5, fielder independent pitching matching it right around 5. So his results have been pretty much replacement level in the major leagues, but it's a really small sample. He's been in professional baseball forever. He was drafted in 2008, and I'll give you one guess. Who do you think Pat Venditti was drafted and developed by? He's a guy that the Marlins have just signed. If the Marlins are targeting a player, someone that doesn't have obvious standout success in the major leagues, there's got to be a connection there. So I'll give you about 5 seconds. Guess who drafted and developed Pat Venditti in professional baseball. Of course it was the Yankees. It's always the Yankees. When in doubt, the Marlins acquiring somebody, it has to be an ex-Yankee, considering all the connections that are currently within the Marlins front office. So Venditti spent the first 7 years of his pro career in the Yankees organization, not a high priority at any point. He was a former 20th round draft pick out of Creighton University, which doesn't exactly have a great legacy for baseball. He was actually drafted in consecutive years by the Yankees, both in 2007 when he didn't sign, and then in 2008 as a senior signing. So he's not a guy that ever made a lot of money out of pro baseball, was never a high priority. And when it was clear that he wasn't getting a major league look in the Yankees organization, he signed with the A's as a free agent and immediately made it to the major leagues. So he throws with both hands, all right? And that creates some very interesting situations because, as you know from following baseball, there is a significant portion of the population that switch hits from both sides of the plate. And on the mothership at SB Nation, they did an interesting breakdown about the quandary that comes up when switch pitcher Pat Venditti comes up against a switch hitter.
He was playing for the Staten Island Yankees in the minor leagues against the Brooklyn Cyclones. Mm. And switch hitter Ralph Henriquez comes up to the plate. And now there's a little bit of like decision-making happening because Henriquez has just seen Pat Venditti warm up with his left hand.
Okay.
But when he gets to the mound, he has his glove on his left hand, and he's getting ready to pitch with his right hand. So Ralph switches to the other batter's box.
Okay.
So then Pat Venditti goes, well, I'll just pitch with my other hand now.
Screw that.
So he takes off his glove, and he switches to the other hand, at which point Ralph goes, well, I'm just going to switch to the other batter's box now. And this happens back and forth for a significant amount of time before the game comes to an absolute screeching halt, and the umpire spends, no joke, six solid minutes on the field trying to figure out how to deal with this situation that Pat Venditti's very specific physiology has introduced into this game.
Wait, so what else? Like, was this the start of an inning so they could kind of just, like,
Mess around. This is ended up being the final at bat of the game. The Brooklyn Cyclones were behind by 5 runs, and they had 2 outs already.
So very meaningful.
So very meaningful. Yes. Put an asterisk on this game, big time. No, it meant nothing. It meant nothing. It was just a bunch of dudes having a pissing match over a very specific rule that had not yet been written. And as a matter of fact, Major League Baseball watched this happen. And said, we need to get a rule on the books as soon as possible.
Oh, boy.
And so that this never happens again.
Sir, something is happening in Brooklyn right now. You need to see this.
So MLB puts a rule on the books, and they ended up not needing it for another 7 years, which is how long it took Pat Venditti to get called up.
Oh, okay.
A's. And then he did pitch his MLB debut in 2015.
Wait, so what was the actual rule that they decided?
The rule they landed on basically lets the pitcher decide what hand he wants to throw with when he gets to the mound. The actual text is, a pitcher must indicate visually to the umpire-in-chief, the batter, and any runners, the hand with which he intends to pitch, which may be done by wearing his glove on the other hand while touching the pitcher's plate.
Okay.
So you walk up, you pick what hand you want to pitch with, and then the batter decides what box he's going to stand in, and then you just do that at bat.
Okay,
in.
So and that's per at bat. So
right. So okay. He can switch in between batters if he wants to.
Okay.
But as soon as he goes up to the pitcher's plate with that ball in his hand, he's got to pitch with that hand for the rest of the appearance.
Yes, that led to the passage of a new rule in baseball to specify how the order of events are supposed to go when a switch pitcher comes up against a switch hitter. It's ultimately the batter that gets to make the final call, where he sees the arm that the pitcher declares with, and he's able to give himself the platoon advantage by stepping to the opposite side of the batter's box. In the major leagues, Venditti's experience is pretty split evenly between facing lefties and facing righties. And of course, if he were to have it his way, every single plate appearance would come with him having the platoon advantage, righty on righty or lefty on lefty. But he has faced a total of about 40 plate appearances against switch hitters in his major league career. And so what sticks out is it's great that you could throw with both hands. And it's somewhat interesting that Venditti, at this point in his career, he has reached a pretty consistent approach both ways, regardless of which hand he's throwing with. He has a sinker and he has a slider. In between those pitches, it makes up about 95% of his offerings. At least that's what we have from the StatCast data. He'll very occasionally mix in a changeup in those situations. One thing that was immediately mentioned in the initial report, which came from John Paul Morosi of MLB Network, is that there's a new rule coming to Major League Baseball next year, the three batter minimum. It means that when a new reliever comes into the middle of the game, he either has to face a total of three batters or he has to pitch all the way to the end of that inning if it doesn't take three batters to reach the end of the inning. And Venditti being a guy that in the vast majority of his plate appearances, he has a platoon advantage. Instead of seeing the kind of mixing and matching that you used to see in some bullpen management, this was never really an issue with Don Mattingly anyway. I think less so than any other team, the three batter minimum has a very small effect on the Marlins because Mattingly has never been a guy that is overly obsessive with matching up left and right. But Venditti, being a guy that can obviously just turn around in most situations and have the batter in an uncomfortable situation, he's a guy that even if he's not a star, and there's no indication that he's a star, he's a guy that 34 years old and a 34-year-old journeyman, he's not a high priority for the team. There's a reason they were able to get him on a minor league deal with no strings attached. But the fact that he's able to simply do this makes him it extends his career. It probably wasn't all that clear whether he would make it back to the big leagues, and it's still not a sure thing. But this is a clear opening to do that on a Marlins bullpen that does not have a whole lot of experience whatsoever or a whole lot of superlative performers. The one concern, I guess, that sticks out to me about Venditti, and we're going to get into more of his positives lately, but the concern that sticks out is that he does have pretty wild platoon splits in the major leagues. He against right-handed batters, lifetime 286 batting average against him with a 904 OPS, whereas against left-handed batters, 179 batting average against a 570 OPS. He's been great against lefties. He's been very not great against righties. Against lefties, striking out about 26% that he's faced in his career. That's good. Major league average for against a position player in the low 20s, striking out about 26. Against right-handed batters, it's a different story. Only an 11% career strikeout rate against right-handers. And the issue is that it's not so much that the lack of swing and miss, it's that he also allows a lot of fly balls on batted balls for him. One of the lowest ground ball rates of pitchers in recent years at the major league level, including last year. Last year was even higher than normal. He spent most of last year with the Giants AAA affiliate before making two little appearances at the major league level. And for the AAA team, the ground ball rate just in the mid-30s. As noted in the previous segment, for the 2020 season, the Marlins are bringing in the fences by a handful of feet in dead center field and in right center field. And now they go out and sign Pat Venditti, who has a little bit of a fly ball issue. But I think you guys know by now where I stand on this, that although it was made some interesting news that they brought in the fences, if you actually look at the number of balls that would be affected by the change, it's a very small number. So overall, over the course of the season, even if this guy were able to stick on the roster for an extended period of time, you're talking about maybe one or two situations the entire year as a reliever where he would be affected one way or the other by this. Not a big deal, just an observation, just a little data point that has to go into this signing and the potential fit that he would have if he's able to make it onto the active roster. But before we move on to our other topics, a few more details about Venditti's pitch mix. The reason why he was such a late-round draft pick by the Yankees, why he didn't make it to the majors until nearly age 30, and why he hasn't really stuck around that much is because he has far below average fastball velocity. He throws harder with his right hand. It used to be high 80s fastball, but now as a 34-year-old, just as in almost all other cases, the velocity has dipped a little bit. So now more a lot of 85, 86, 87 fastballs from his right hand. And as a lefty, it's even lower than that, 82, 83, 84, far below average fastball velocity, and that requires him to mix in a lot of sliders. Almost as many sliders as fastballs, alternating between the two to keep batters off balance, and he still gets a pretty decent differential in velocity between those pitches. The breaking ball is in the low to mid-70s. So what stuck out to me about the slider is the spin rate that he has on that pitch. There's not a perfect correlation between spin rate and effectiveness of your pitch, but especially with breaking balls, it is a factor. You want to have as much spin as possible, and that will generally help you miss more bats. And for a guy that has way below average velocity and who we mentioned is vulnerable to fly balls when opponents put it in play, it's very precious for him to miss bats whenever possible, either to get himself ahead in the count or to put batters away. I ran a query through StatCast where, looking since 2016, so over the last four major league seasons, all the pitchers that have thrown at least 300 sliders in the major leagues during that time, and there are several hundred of them. It's basically hundreds. And he is elite in that department when ranking all of them by spin rate. Out of the hundreds of relievers the last four seasons that have thrown at least 300 sliders in the majors, and Venditti just crosses that threshold with 325, number one on the list was Kyle Crick. His spin rate, nearly 3,200 revolutions per minute on the pitch on average. Number two was Trent Thornton. Number three was Marlins fellow reliever Jeff Brigham. So most of those pitches for Brigham came just this past year. 2,934 RPMs on his slider. And that's the reason why I'm really intrigued by Brigham heading into the new year, assuming that the Marlins are able to keep him heading into opening day. Right behind him, Chad Sobotka. And number five out of hundreds of major league pitchers who threw sliders the past few years in average spin rate is Pat Venditti. 2,913 revolutions per minute on his average slider. To go down the list a little bit further, number seven is Chaz Rowe. Chaz Rowe very famously gets extraordinary movement laterally on his pitch, and he's been in the majors now for a handful of years. Number nine in this category, slider spin rate, is Sergio Romo, who, of course, got a lucrative deal from the Twins, and the Marlins were interested in re-signing him. Number 11 is Adam Ottavino, who is an elite reliever now with the Yankees. And right behind him is Walker Buehler, who is one of the rising young potential aces with the Dodgers. It's not a perfect correlation between that spin rate and being a successful pitcher, and not even perfect between the spin rate and being a great pitch, but it's better than nothing. It's certainly the most appealing thing that I found about Venditti, and some optimism about why he could be effective for the Marlins, potentially. Considering his handedness is going to give him somewhat of an inside track to sneak onto the roster. It depends what the Marlins do from here. I've been pretty consistent with my thinking that they should be investing some more in it, in one more veteran reliever that has late-inning experience in the major leagues. And there's still a few of them out there that should be had on one-year deals. It'll cost a few million dollars, whereas Venditti, even if he makes it to the majors, he'll be earning about the league minimum, and then he's under club control for the foreseeable future. If the Marlins like what they see from him and he makes it through the year, then he's not even arbitration eligible until 2022. You get next season at a bargain rate, and assuming that Venditti doesn't pitch high leverage innings, this is going to be a guy that's extremely affordable all the way through the next handful of years. But that's certainly looking ahead very far, because first he has to make the roster. In my mind, it's a safer bet to go after somebody that is more experienced at the major league level, but Venditti is someone that has gotten pretty rave reviews as a person for his intangibles that he brings to a team. So if nothing else, just a positive presence to have around spring training, and someone that is, once we see him in games during the Grapefruit League, it's very easy content for people like us at Fish Stripes to get fans curious about these games that ultimately don't count. An interesting signing, and again, probably not the last. There's now, in total, he's only the third pitcher that has been a non-roster invitee to Marlins spring training. Usually that number is significantly higher, even with all the interesting arms that the Marlins have internally that want to get a look from the coaching staff. I expect a couple more signings, hopefully one at the major league level, but Venditti is certainly a low risk, medium reward acquisition that fits in with the direction that baseball is heading in 2020. The third and final current events topic on this Fish Bites episode, the 2020 Don't Blink Home Run Derby in Paradise, which took place this past Saturday in the Bahamas with a whole lot of Marlins participating. This is the second straight year that I've played close attention to this Home Run Derby, and even more so than last year, a lot of Marlins involvement. First and foremost, it's meant to build up baseball in the Bahamas. It's organized by a couple Bahamian professional baseball players, and it's meant to grow the game in the Bahamas, which has become an increasingly fertile ground for finding professional baseball talent, most notably on the Marlins. One of their top overall prospects right now is Jazz Chisholm, who is a native Bahamian, and this is he may have participated all 3 years. This is the third annual year of the event. I know he participated last year, and this year he was one of the featured players as well. So were Ian Lewis, who was a recent international signing by the Marlins this past summer.
Jerron Sands, who many of you know, is one of the co-founders of IBA Elite, which has been responsible for a number of these guys getting signed to minor league baseball contracts as he drives that one well out beyond the boundary on his foul swing of the bat to give him a grand total of 7 to open things up for Team Fox.
That's pretty good for Ian, considering, look at the size. He's probably 150 pounds.
Yeah, he's not a big guy, but he's definitely generating some bat speed, able to get some good power on his shots there.
They also had Anfernee Seymour, who was developed by the Marlins. He returned to the team this past year in the minor leagues. And at this very moment, he's actually a free agent. But in the lead up to the event and even introducing him at the Derby, he was introduced as a Marlins player. So even though he's a current free agent, I'm not sure if he's going to re-sign with the team. He's another Marlins affiliated player. Also participating, Monte Harrison. He participated last year as well. And the winner of the 2020 Home Run Derby in Paradise was Lewis Brinson, with 32 total home runs, including 13 in the championship rounds. He got stronger as the Derby went on, and as someone that watched nearly every single swing of the Derby, I can tell you that he was not getting cheap shots. He hit some of the most majestic home runs into the ocean out of anybody.
Some of these guys, like, come on, way up.
Lewis Brinson right now is hitting some absolute taters. Yeah. I mean,
he's hitting them right.
He's got 8 already.
He swung the way you did. This is almost always the same distance.
Yeah, Lewis. Repetition. Lewis, he's a freak, man. Lewis just got a tough one for him.
Yeah. So he's now got 9 home runs already. I think last year you hit last after Todd, wasn't it? You go against Todd. Todd had a pretty good round. And we were saying he put some pressure on you, and you just came up and just
so easy. Made it look so easy.
Dang, how many swings did I take?
Meanwhile, I don't know how many swings I took, but he's got 11 home runs already. 12 swings, okay, so.
12 swings?
That's his 13th.
And they give it 14 swings, maybe?
13 home runs out of 15 swings. That's pretty impressive.
I should take a second to explain what makes this event unique, in that they set up a platform on the beach that is facing out to the ocean. You have a guy on the dock. There's a dock jutting out into the water, and that's where the pitcher is throwing BP to you, and you aim directly out into the ocean, where they set up a makeshift fence on the surface of the water. Not quite the same dimensions as a typical professional baseball field. Probably more like 300 feet instead of 350 or 400. But still a home run derby, and you're limited to a certain number of swings. It was about 15 swings per round, and there were dozens of competitors listed originally on the lineup. Were 30 hitters, all of whom have some sort of professional baseball experience. Eason Diaz was on that list as well, the fellow major leaguer. And so I'm a little unclear what happened, because I think just the day before the Derby, he was listed on the itinerary, on the lineup, and he did not ultimately play in the Derby. But out of the 30 players, the vast majority of them that were listed on the lineup did end up hitting, and Brinson led the whole field. He had won the stronger first rounds in order to make it into the final eight, and then in the second rounds, he had 11 more home runs to get himself into the finals, and then into the finals, he unseated one of the fellow Bahamian players, who you'd expect had somewhat of a home field advantage, who had a lot of local support. Also, during this weekend, a former Marlins World Series champ, Charles Johnson, was in the area. He has he was there in some sort of association with Major League Baseball itself. They brought some film crews down there, and this was one of the priorities of this whole setup, was to grow the game in the Bahamas. It's become an increasingly fertile ground for baseball talent, and they held, just the day before the Derby on last Friday, they held some impromptu camp for young players, teaching them some of the basics as hitters, as fielders, as base runners, with the actual players themselves as guest instructors. So that was really cool, and I'm sure you're going to see on Major League Baseball's on the website or on their social media feeds, I think they're going to be sharing some of the specifics about those camps and growing the game for the next generation of players. I want to focus on the Derby on Saturday because, of course, Brinson won. Jazz Chisholm was another standout performer. He made it into the final eight, and it's a really cool event, and Brinson seemed to take a lot of pride in his victory. I went out of the way to record highlights from all the Marlins players that were participating. You can find that on our YouTube, our new YouTube page, the Fish Stripes on YouTube, where I uploaded all the rounds for all the Marlins that were participating, including all three of Brinson's rounds, all 32 of his home runs, and all the commentary to go along with that.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Of course, during Major League regular season action, Brinson has been one of the biggest disappointments of this entire rebuild for the Marlins, the centerpiece of the Christian Yelich trade. 2 years in a row, breaking out of spring training, penciled in as the everyday starting center fielder, and in 2018, losing that job in the middle of the year due to injury. In 2019, somehow even far, he was below such a low bar that he set in 2018, and he somehow disappointed even more than that this past season, getting demoted to AAA New Orleans, where he spends about half the year trying to readjust, trying to fix things. And he returned to the majors in August, given one other opportunity to play on a nearly regular basis, and the offense just still isn't there. He was one of a very small number of baseball players last year in the major leagues who didn't hit a home run. He had a couple hundred plate appearances in the majors, the year of the juiced ball, and you can make excuses for Marlins Park. There was one notable home run. I remember one notable would-be home run that he hit in Colorado over 420 feet away that was robbed from him, but you can make all the tiny adjustments you want. He's simply one of the worst offensive players in the major leagues over the past couple years for a guy that was universally regarded as a top prospect. Now for his lifetime in the major leagues, 183 batting average, a 531 OPS. I ran the research a few months ago, right at the end of the regular season, and the outlook is very grim. You just cannot find other outfielders in the recent history of baseball on any team in any situation that as 24, 25-year-olds, which is these days at that age, it's still relatively young, but not all that far removed from entering your prime of your career. And to struggle to this extent in the majors over a very significant sample, up over 700 career plate appearances in the majors and not produce, has been mystifying. He's been great in spring training each of the last 2 years. When he went down to AAA, he demonstrated more of that power using their own juiced ball. And heading into this new year, he still has a minor league option remaining. Breaking ties with him right now would be selling low, and you wouldn't expect to get much in return at all, which is leading to the expectation that he's still going to be with the Marlins in 2020, and at least coming out of spring training, he'll once again have somewhat of a decent shot of breaking camp with the major league team, especially now that there's an extra active roster spot. I want to be crystal clear that Branson's Derby performance means absolutely nothing for a potential turnaround to his major league career. It's just the latest reminder that he's still a premium athlete. He was universally regarded as that great prospect, the consensus number one Marlins prospect entering the 2018 season, because he has these exceptional tools. His power, his throwing arm, his defense, his base running. The only question was the hit tool, and of course, what's given him so much trouble in the major leagues are secondary pitches. Anything besides a fastball, he's had a lot of trouble just recognizing that out of the pitcher's hands, getting any sort of contact on it. A lifetime strikeout rate in the majors, right around, are we up to 30%? 29.8% in the major leagues. And this Derby performance won't do anything to change that. He was given very hittable pitches, as you normally would during a Derby. But it's another reason why you just can't quit on Brinson quite yet, because he's still motivated to, he's still in shape. He hasn't let his roster spot or his major league salary change his work habits off the field. I mean, the question is whether he just has all the ingredients, tangible, intangible, to make it click in the major leagues. This is going to be coming into his age 26 season, turning 26 early in the regular season. And even though the Marlins have added outfield talent this offseason in the name of Corey Dickerson, they have some great outfield prospects on the way, held in the same kind of high regard that Brinson was not that long ago, like Monte Harrison, like Jesus Sanchez, and further down, like J.J. Bleday and Cameron Meisner and Connor Scott and Gerard Encarnacion. There's a lot of talent coming. This is really this is a true make-or-break year for Brinson, and even more so, there's going to be a lot of scrutiny early in the year. I'm glad that this performance should have helped his confidence a little bit, and just showing the talent that's still there for being able to do a lot of impact on a baseball. I mean, that's a very basic element that you need as a potential impact player. It's everything else that remains a big question for Brinson heading into spring training. Anyway, I encourage you to check out all those Derby highlights uploaded to YouTube, Fish Stripes on YouTube, as well as on fishstripes.com. I wrote up a full article embedding all the highlights and putting everything into a full perspective. It's a great event that they have going on in the Bahamas. And as recently as last summer, signing Ian Lewis, trading for Jazz Chisholm, those won't be the last Bahamian players that you hear about potentially in the Marlins organization. It is a growing hotbed for baseball talent, guys that are really enthusiastic about the game, and a whole lot of credit to Lucius Fox and Todd Isaacs. They were the co-organizers of this event from the beginning, and they were participating in the Derby themselves this past year. So credit to them for putting on this event, because it is really making an impact and helping baseball become even more of an international game. From every corner of the baseball industry, pundits, reporters, fans, and opposing fans, there's almost a universal agreement that the Marlins have done very well for themselves this offseason. A handful of offensive improvements, signing Corey Dickerson, Jesus Aguilar, trading for Jonathan Villar, and even a high-quality backup like Francisco Cervelli, who could have effects on the other side of the ball. The signings of Yimi Garcia and some of these non-roster invitee pickups, the decision to swallow the rest of Wei-Yin Chen's contract and to free up another roster spot to protect some of their high-upside young players. You put it all together, and they've spent money that almost replaces all the money they had coming off the books last year, except this time, they, aside from the dead money on the Chen contract, they don't have any inefficient deals on their books. So they've really cleared up all their financial flexibility for the long term. In these moves, taking on little to no risk in a lot of these signings, and leaving themselves open to trade some veterans in the future to get even more young controllable assets if necessary. But at very least, on paper, this team is far improved from where they were in 2019, where they had a 57-105 record. At this point, it's very hard to see them losing more than 100 games again with the current roster. And there's a lot of upside because of their much improved farm system, one that MLB Pipeline ranked as the most improved farm system during the year of 2019. The handful of trades they made during the middle of the year to creatively improve and address positions, how well they did during the 2019 draft, where they finally used that high position they had in the draft order, and in international free agency, yet again, spending big money on several key infielders in particular that have a lot of upside moving forward. This organization is certainly trending in the right direction any way you look at it. And maybe that's not saying a whole lot considering where they've been the past couple years, but it's positive nonetheless. And it's going to start showing itself at the major league level in the very near future. So fans can be excited about it. But what should we do about it? What are the cons? Why is it happening? For not to oversimplify it, but that's a key question that we should look at, is how did this happen? And it's easy to credit some of the changes that have come to the organization. Of course, at the ownership level, getting rid of Jeffrey Loria and David Sampson and bringing in guys that are more collaborative and that are more experienced. A lot of them have New York Yankees roots, but some of them from other organizations as well. Building out the international scouting department, building up the internal education department that this franchise now has for both its English-speaking and its foreign language-speaking players, in getting them to integrate with one another in ways that probably wasn't the case under the previous ownership. A lot of new faces that have come in, but the one prominent old face that has carried over since the beginning of the old ownership for nearly two decades now, Michael Hill, has been with the Marlins. He is entering his 18th season as a Marlins employee in their front office after previously playing professionally, after previously attending Harvard University. And Michael is still here, and he is entering, based on most recent reports from John Heyman of MLB Network, this is the final year of his contract with the Marlins. It took some people by surprise when he survived the transition of ownership, considering he was in the room when a lot of their previous poor baseball transactions were made, and the fact that the initial reaction to some of the rebuilding trades were more negative. And if you want to be objective about it, the value that they got in some of those initial trades wasn't quite as clearly a net positive as their more recent transactions. There was some reason to believe that he might not stick around, that Derek Jeter and Bruce Sherman would put out their own search to find a new leader of baseball operations. Michael Hill, now in his, this will be his seventh season as president of baseball operations of the Marlins. In title, he's the guy that is making a lot of big calls for this team. And we know under the current front office, it's a little more collaborative with what Jeter brings, what Gary Denbo brings. His focus is more on amateur and prospects as in player development, but he has a very loud voice and he has a strong personality in that war room. But Michael Hill has been here through it all, and things are going so well, we think. Well, generally speaking, and even if that doesn't pay immediate dividends, if we can all agree that this has been one of the better off seasons in recent Marlins memory, then shouldn't somebody be rewarded for that? And entering what is believed to be the final year of his contract, Michael Hill seems to be a pretty obvious extension candidate. The Marlins probably would not have been keeping him all that long if he were overpaid. None of this is public information, but I think we're led to assume that he is rather modestly paid by baseball executive standards, considering the lack of major league results that his teams have had all of last decade, failing to have a single winning season even under the previous front office. There were clear concerns about his track record, and he's someone that, fair or not, as a public speaking personality, he's friendly, he's accessible, he's not necessarily inspiring. And I'll give you a soundbite right here to give you an example of that.
Well, I think we just went with what the draft was presenting us. You know, we always go for the most impactful piece. As I've said, there were some very impactful college bats at the top of the draft. So good for us that we had the opportunity to you know, evaluate those college bats. And, you know, as I said, we're happy to add one to the mix to give us that, you know, another potential impactful, you know, position player piece that, you know, will help us win championships here in South Florida.
Hill doesn't exactly fit the new age baseball executive prototype of being analytical and being so innovative and being white, to be blunt about it. That maybe doesn't matter all that much if we just see the bottom line transactions that are being made with him involved in the collaboration. There's a lot to be said for having continuity. And assuming the Marlins haven't done this already, maybe they did behind the scenes, because info about these executives isn't quite as transparent as it is about players. Maybe they've already worked out a longer deal with him. It just seems, assuming they haven't, it just seems unnecessary to risk breaking up what you believe is finally a functional formula within a front office. That shouldn't be taken for granted. As recently as a couple years ago, there were doubts about whether bringing in Gary Denbo and the way he interacted with his new, quote, teammates, whether that was all healthy and whether this organization was on the right track. And now we have what amounts to not just this offseason, but really almost a full year of information showing a lot of creative decisions being made with Michael Hill, if not the only one involved with it, and maybe even not the loudest voice in the room, he's in the middle of it. As much as I advocate for spending on young, talented, homegrown players, most notably Brian Anderson, I think maybe that's the one area that jumps out to you as something that the Marlins have overlooked, in that they've not yet reached any of these low-risk, long-term deals with some of their most talented homegrown players. That's going to be a very critical step for them, because as we'll investing in free agency on high caliber players this offseason, spending on a lot of decent role players, but not necessarily any guys of a certain impact pedigree that you can count on. There's going to come a point within the next year, I'd say, where you have to see the Marlins taking some of these bigger risks in order to lock up guys that have super high potential to really put this team back into contention. And so that's still to be determined, is how Hill and company spend on starter level, everyday caliber, or for top of the rotation, like free agents or their own homegrown players. They have to select very carefully. There is somewhat of a science to this. It's not every decision will work out, but they have to, they'll have to take these risks eventually, and they'll have to prove that they can distinguish between several comparable options, players that have similar tools or track records. They'll have to show that they have the analysis and foresight and the developmental infrastructure to get the most out of these players moving forward and bring this rebuild all the way out on the other end. But at this juncture, considering the recent events and how many of them appear to align pretty well with the team's overall objective, just don't, if it ain't broke, then don't make all that many changes to the decision-making structure that the Marlins have. So if Michael Hill needs a new contract, and despite all the dysfunction that he was around earlier this decade, This is a guy that's been with the organization almost as long as anybody else that is currently with the Marlins team. He was the one key holdover in the front office in the baseball decision-making structure from the old regime. And finally, we've reached a point where he is he's helping and bring this team to the right direction. Whether it happens prior to opening day or even during the season, my vote is for continuity in this Marlins front office now that everybody appears to be on the same page. I'm curious what you guys have to say about it. When I floated the idea on Twitter prior to this recording, it was met with a lot of initial skepticism or disagreement even about Hill's status on the team. So be sure to reach out to us on fishstripes.com, on Twitter, Instagram, about your thoughts about Michael Hill and this offseason in general. As always, I greatly appreciate all the Marlins fans that support us, that are part of the Fish Stripes community, that inspire the conversations that we have on the podcast and on the website. 2020 is going to be the most exciting year in a while. So tell a friend. We want to get as many perspectives as possible to be part of the same community and help us break down what should be a really interesting year around the organization. I'm Eli Sussman. Go Fish!